Welcome to Wellness Wednesday on All Sides with Ann Fisher. A Central Ohio orthopedic practice that specializes in hip and knee replacements is among nine national centers collaborating on a first-of-its-kind study to improve outcomes with mobile technology. Mary Ann Johns, who had a knee replacement in early December, is the Ohio patient enrolled in this, is one of the Ohio patients enrolled in the study. She joins us. Welcome to the show.
Thank you. Nice to be here.
And by phone, orthopedic surgeon with Joint Implant Surgeons in New Albany, Dr. Keith Behrend. Welcome to the show.
Thank you so much. Thanks for having me.
So, Dr. Behrend, tell us about the study, you know, and why you got involved.
Well, it's actually pretty exciting. So this is the largest study of its kind. It's with a company who manufactures the implants called Zimmer Biomet. And they've partnered with Apple to launch a nationwide study that by the end of the enrollment will have over 11,000 patients enrolled. And the whole journey of care around hip and knee replacement is both monitored and managed through a platform called MyMobility and the use of the Apple Watch. And so, as Mary Ann can attest to, it's a very exciting technology, but I'm very hopeful that the things we're going to learn from the over 11,000 patients are going to improve care overall for patients around the world.
This isn't about the surgery, but it's about the aftercare.
Well, it's about the care before
and
after. So the patients are enrolled and start working with the MyMobility app between 2 and 6 weeks before surgery, so roughly a month before surgery. Helps them get ready for what to expect, to make sure they're doing all of the right things ahead of time. And then afterwards, monitoring their care, helping them with their therapy and their rehabilitation. And then monitoring their recovery journey for actually a year post-operatively. And so that information is going to be incredibly valuable.
So, Mary Ann Johns, tell us what the before surgery experience was like with this Zimmer, or what do we call it, MyMobility.
MyMobility.
Yeah.
I planned my surgery 3 weeks ahead of time. So I got the watch three weeks ahead of time and started doing it's a combination of education and also exercises. Mm-hmm. So for 3 weeks. So every day I would get a jingle that said you have things on your to-do list. So it's paired with an app on your phone. So I'd go to my phone and check out what my to-do items were for the day. And sometimes it was, you know, a blurb about how to get ready, how to get your house ready, you know, pick up throw rugs, make sure you have you have food prepared ahead of time. Anyway, a lot of things that are helpful so that when you have the surgery, you're ready when you come home.
Mm-hmm.
So the education part, but then also there were exercise routines that you do one or two times a day, every other day.
Such as?
I think it's a combination of things that improve your strength, but also improve your range of motion. So I think it's believed that, you know, the better your range of motion is before you go into surgery, the better it will be coming out. That may be, you know, sort of what you're aiming to get back to.
Oh, Dr. Behrend, how are these customized? So is it going to make, you know, sense for what Mary Ann Johns' lifestyle is versus somebody else's?
Yes. Well, it's customizable mostly by the practice that's using the MyMobility platform. And so prior to our launching MyMobility through this study at Joint Implant Surgeons, we went through a sort of checklist, a logistical list of how do we specifically, you know, what kind of therapy do we like to do? What type of blood clot prophylaxis do we use? What type of infection prophylaxis do we use? How aggressive are we with stair climbing, for example, after surgery? And so we would really tailor that to the likes and needs of our patient population in general. And then the application is further tuned to the individual patient as they interact with it.
Are these kinds of prompts that Mary Ann is getting, are these kinds of things that you'd give them on an information sheet anyways beforehand?
Correct. So it's digitizing a lot of the information that we give beforehand and postoperatively. And traditionally, it's been in a notebook or in a classroom setting where there's a lot of information coming at you at once that can be very confusing. And you also will run into situations where you'll get different information from, say, the staff at the surgery center, or from a physical therapist that you might see that's in your community. And with My Mobility, it's a set message, and that message is set throughout the entire recovery journey, so that you're hearing the message that your surgeon actually wants you to hear.
So do you then coordinate with the physical therapists out in the community, or are they on board, or how does that work so that there aren't contradictions?
Well, so the first phase of the My Mobility study that Mary Ann's enrolled in is mm-hmm. literally the onboarding. How difficult is it, the logistics of using it, how hard is it, how much time does it take, how much time does it take my staff, how much time does it take the patient?
Mm-hmm.
The next phase of the study, phase two, will be a randomized prospective study where patients will be enrolled in the Apple Watch My Mobility arm of the study or traditional physical therapy to try to see if this can literally eliminate physical therapy altogether. My belief is that it won't.
Mm-hmm.
I think it's going to be a good adjunct for therapy, but that we're always going to have therapists at some level. Hopefully it can make it more financially viable, and it can really help the value proposition of going to see a therapist. But along the same lines, the My Mobility app is there with the patient when they go to their therapist, and even if it's not a therapist that we work with routinely, they've got the exact information that we want portrayed to the patient. And if the therapist is helping them do that, great. If they're doing it on their own at home, which I believe Mary Ann has been,
correct.
That's great as well.
Mm-hmm. You're listening to Wellness Wednesday on All Sides with Ann Fisher. We're talking about a new study. It's a nationwide study. There is one hip and knee replacement surgical practice in Ohio that's participating, and we're talking with joint implant orthopedic surgeon Dr. Keith Barrand in New Albany right now by phone, and also with us Mary Ann Johns. She's the first patient enrolled in the Joint Impact Surgeons study, My Mobility application. If you have a question or comment about this, give us a call. Don't wait. 614-292-8513 or email us at allsides@wosu.org. So, Mary Ann Johns, do you get to keep the watch?
No, you don't. And you have to keep the box. And return it with
the box.
The box.
Okay.
Yes.
Well, how has it been? I mean, is it a hassle? Is it irritating? I mean, what's the experience been like?
Well, for me personally, it's been very easy, and I really like it. I had a Fitbit before, so I was sort of used to tracking things.
Mm-hmm.
I've had a trainer in the past, and I go to the gym fairly regularly. So, you know, the exercises that it has me do are fairly familiar to me. There are things about the app that I think, you know, that maybe could be tweaked. I kind of keep my own secret little list of things that I would suggest that they, you know, consider, you know, doing differently or fixing or whatever. And I have even had a phone call with somebody from the My Mobility app about a number of these things that didn't function the way I thought they were going to function.
Like, give us an example.
One example is that there was one day, this was before the surgery, where I got a routine that I was supposed to do, and I did the routine. And so what's cool is that after you do the exercises, so there are 10 reps, and it says, how many did you do? And you click, 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 and say, I did all 10.
Yeah.
Then you do the next, and next, and next. And when you're all done, you hit done, close, and then it goes away. And then it pops up again, and you'll see a check mark. You did that. And there was one day where it didn't notice that I had done it. Like, I had gone through that process.
And you wanted validation.
I wanted credit, yes. Part of the motivating aspect of the app is that it does keep track of this.
Yeah.
And, you know, there's a little icon at the bottom of the app where you can check your statistics. How much have you complied with what's expected for you to do? And I wanted, you know, an A+.
Right. You're a high achiever. Okay.
Yeah. You know, motivated. But, I had talked to them about that. It turns out it was quirky. It only happened that one day. So.
It was just a quirk. Okay.
Mm-hmm.
Let's turn to a question. Chris and is it Galena? Hi, Chris.
Great topic. And oh my gosh, an Apple Watch app to do this is amazing. I had knee surgery about 4 years ago, and I had been working with a trainer for years before that. And I said, I'm going to have knee surgery in about 8 weeks, and, like, I really want to get ready for this. And So we just like really, really, really worked on my legs and strength and muscles and range of motion, just kind of, you know, with what she said. I had my surgery, came out of surgery, had the first therapist come to my house, and she was like blown away by how much I could do. And my post-therapy sessions were, you know, I had like, I don't know, 12, and I only went to like 6 because I had great range of motion. And
you graduated to early.
Yeah. And I've had a lot of friends who've had surgery, and they don't do I called it prehab, I think it's great to recognize that we should be preparing our bodies for the surgery. Mm-hmm. In order to get good results afterwards.
That's getting to be, thank you, Chris, for that. It's getting to be a lot bigger deal, right, Dr. Behrend?
That's correct. And as Mary Ann said, I mean, I think there is the rehabilitative side of it, or the prehab, as our caller just mentioned, and we're firm believers in a rapid recovery is really dependent upon that prehab. And it's tough to do sometimes. There's certain insurance plans that will limit the amount of therapy that you can do. And, boy, if you want to have those therapy visits postoperatively, it's tough to want to burn those visits preoperatively, and we believe that not only in the tracking of the patients and the helping them postoperatively, but doing exactly that, running the prehab through the MyMobility application and the Apple Watch, is going to add even more value to what we're seeing, and things like preparing your home. I mean, mm-hmm. most trainers maybe don't know that we got to pick up the loose rugs and we got to make sure we've got a handrail and we've got to. Mm-hmm. So it not only helps with the prehab, but it helps you in preparation to have a safer journey when you get home as well.
David in Upper Arlington, you're on the air. Hi, David.
Hello. I want to recommend physical therapy. I have a rotator cuff problems in both shoulders. Mm-hmm. I couldn't put on a shirt without very bad pain. I was given fewer than 5 exercises to do. I do them every day. I have no pain in shoulders.
Mm-hmm.
I have knee, bone on bone, couldn't stand, sit, or walk. 3 physical therapy exercises, I can walk a mile. Hmm. I do them every day. They do strengthen and they do stretch.
Okay.
You have to do physical therapy after surgery. You do it before and you may not need the surgery.
Right, exactly. Yeah, in fact, do you see, does it change necessarily, Dr. Behrend, when you do that, you know, when you faithfully do the prehab, as our other caller referred to it, does it change the outcome when you're going in for surgery? I mean, does it change maybe what you're going to do or not?
Yes, it changes. It even changes things like the amount of pain medication that you require. There's
okay.
been studies that have been done for nearly 2 decades about prehab and preoperative education that we also talked about with the MyMobility app. Where that just that education ahead of time, how would that correlate with less narcotics postoperatively? I'm not exactly sure how that happens, but it mm-hmm. does. And in this day and age, that's a critical component of what we're trying to accomplish is less pain, less narcotics, faster recovery, better recovery, and you know, we really feel like this technology is going to help us out.
Just before I let you go, Dr. Behrend, I wanted to know, you know, every year more than 1 million people get knee or hip replacements. That number is expected to grow to 3.5 million by 2035. I guess it's just because of our aging population, partly, and increasingly active, maybe. But what the heck is going on?
You hit the nail on the head. There's 3 variables. There's the baby boomer generation, which is our largest generation, coming through the sort of arthritis times. People are just unwilling to give up their activity. Even the weekend warriors, you know, if your knee hurt bad enough, 15, 20 years ago, you just would give up that thing that you enjoyed, and that would just be part of your quality of life would change.
Mm-hmm.
Now we're unwilling to do that, and we're going to go seek out care sooner in order to maintain a better quality of life. And then the third thing, unfortunately, is the obesity epidemic.
Mm.
I mean, it's pretty simple physics that if you're carrying a lot of extra weight across the knee joint, for example, the kneecap joint sees upwards of 8 times the body weight when going up and down stairs quickly. And so you can imagine if you're severely overweight that those joints are going to wear out pretty quickly. So it's a combination of those things.
Well, the prognosis then changes too. Are you looking at, I mean, who are you trying to get to sign up for this study? Is it going to be a broad spectrum of your clients?
Yeah. So
or patients, I should say?
Yeah, patients, yes,
yeah.
ma'am. The enrollment criteria now are basically you have to have an Apple iPhone 6 or newer mm-hmm. and be willing to participate in the study. And so it is a broad, there's very few sites. We're the only site in Ohio at Joint Implant Surgeons that are enrolling patients.
Mm-hmm.
And there's very few centers across the country that are enrolling. And as I mentioned, we're going to eventually enroll over 11,000 patients. And so we want to have very broad, very open enrollment. And in the last phase of the study with 10,000 patients wearing the watch, that's when we're going to hopefully have a broad enough brushstroke of patients that we'll be able to really hone in on things like what was the watch telling us before surgery that correlated with a good outcome? What was the watch telling us in the first few weeks after surgery that correlated with a complication, and can we intervene more quickly? Are there certain demographics, certain patient populations, certain regions that do better or do worse based on what the information the watch is giving back to us?
Uh-huh.
And so we should be able to intervene and actually improve outcomes for all 3 million that are going to have joint replacements in 2035, even if they're not wearing a watch.
Dr. Keith Behrendt, thanks for joining us. I appreciate it.
Well, I really appreciate it. Thank you so much. And thank you, Marianne, very much for
it's my pleasure.
Dr. Keith Behrendt is hip and knee surgeon with Joint Implant Surgeons in New Albany and founding physician at New Albany Surgical Hospital. Also with us, Marianne Johns. Thanks for your time today. I appreciate it.
You're very welcome.
Marianne Johns is the first patient enrolled in the Joint Impact Surgeons study, My Mobility application, that Joint Implant Surgeons in New Albany is one of 9 centers across the country participating in this study. We will continue Wellness Wednesday, so stay with us. This is All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News. Welcome back to Wellness Wednesday. I'm your host, Ann Fisher. Don't eat raw cookie dough. That's not just your mom talking. That's according to the Centers for Disease Control, which issued a warning last week urging people not to eat raw cookie dough and its raw ingredients. We're talking about preventive care and how to protect yourself from foodborne illnesses. Joining us now by phone is physician assistant in the Center for Functional Medicine at the Cleveland Clinic, Sarah Cawley. Welcome to the show, Sarah.
Thanks, Ann.
So given the American penchant for raw cookie dough, the number of more than 60 people in the U.S. sickened by E. coli from raw flour, it kind of appears sort of low, but is that just what is getting reported?
Sure. So with raw cookie dough, there's two things actually that can make you sick. The flour, which can always contains E. coli if it's contaminated, and the eggs, which typically contain salmonella. So two good reasons not to eat this. And, there's different people are susceptible, older adults, infants, people with weak immune systems. And so, it's a lower number because they're obligated to report on certain types of illnesses. But there could be many more people that are affected by a milder form because they have a healthy immune system and never even seek medical care because they think it's systemic flu.
Like I said, my grandma said the same thing. It's not news that there may be harmful bacteria in raw food, right?
Correct. This is kind of old news, but it seems to circle back around, especially during this time of year, because people are busy making not only, Christmas cookies and things of that nature, but also holiday dough ornaments, something you might not think about, children being exposed to that raw flour when they're making their dough ornaments.
And they're just sticking their fingers in their mouth or something like that?
Exactly. So that, little kids love to put their fingers in their mouth. They're not washing their hands after they're touching the raw flour. And if they have something that's contaminated, they could potentially become ill.
It seems so strange that flour has E. coli in it.
It does seem strange, but we know that, many, despite our best, food safety practices, these things can become contaminated. The outbreak in 2016 was actually traced back to a single source of flour production that was in several different brands of flour. So, you know, even a small little outbreak can be widely dispersed in that way.
Mm. What are the most common food bacteria that can hurt us?
Most commonly would be the E. coli or Salmonella. Like I described, you know, there's many different subtypes. E. coli is something that actually lives in all of our intestines and can be easily transmitted because we don't wash our hands. Salmonella, of course, most commonly associated with raw eggs, and most people know that. And, of course, wash their hands, you know, wash food surfaces and things after food preparation. But those are the two most common ones that would affect us.
You're listening to Wellness Wednesday on All Sides with Ann Fisher. We're talking about foodborne illnesses. There can be an uptick this time of year when it comes to cookie dough, raw cookie dough, because you're eating, you love the taste of it. We all can relate, but it can be dangerous. And also those dough ornaments that a lot of kids make, they can put their fingers in their mouth. They can get sick from that as well. My guest is Sarah Cawley. She's a physician assistant in the Center for Functional Medicine at the Cleveland Clinic. If you have a question about foodborne illnesses, give us a call, 614-292-8513, or email us at allsides@wosu.org. Why are some people more vulnerable to these kinds of foodborne illnesses than others? What do you mean by that?
So older adults tend, and infants, you know, people with weakened immune systems, such as somebody receiving, you know, chemotherapy and things of that nature, they would be just more susceptible. Their body doesn't have the same resources to be able to fight the infection, especially people with poor digestive health, because that's where 70% of our immune system actually resides, is in our gut. So we know that these certain populations of people are just more susceptible, and it's especially important to protect to them.
And can you pass on a foodborne illness to someone even though they haven't consumed the contaminated food?
It would be more unlikely for that to happen. However, if somebody, for instance, were ill and then did not wash their hands afterward, certainly that could potentiate the contamination forward to someone else.
Does the kind of sickness you get when it's foodborne, is that different? I mean, we just had a show about norovirus, for instance, and how do you tell the difference, or is it that you can't tell the difference?
Well, in many cases, it's very difficult to tell the difference to, you know, a consumer or someone, a patient that would just become ill, especially if the symptoms are more mild. If somebody did, for instance, come to the hospital, there's specialized testing we can do of their, you know, stool samples, things like that, that we could diagnose the illness. But depending on how sick, you know, like I said, some people might not even go to the hospital.
Mm-hmm.
Norovirus is just that. It's a virus that's self-limited, usually runs its course. The common thread between all three of these things, though, is that they can all cause dehydration, which might potentially need to be treated.
How do you know when there's a quote-unquote outbreak?
Typically, you would see an uptick in people reporting the same symptoms after eating a similar product or food. You know, if these illnesses are diagnosed on culture because someone came to the hospital, those are obligated to be reported to the CDC. And then this is where the CDC keeps track of these things and starts to track these outbreaks.
And when you get sick from E. coli from eating raw dough, for instance, how does it move through your system? How quickly do you get sick?
Well, typically after an E. coli exposure can actually take, you know, sometimes 3 to 4 days to become severely ill, which is what makes it hard to track in the first place.
Right.
And, you know, most people start with nausea, vomiting, sometimes bloody diarrhea, severe stomach cramps, and then, you know, depending on the severity of illness, may end up having to go to the hospital.
Why bloody diarrhea?
Well, E. coli, certain subtypes, and typically the one that is involved in foodborne illness outbreaks, they are certain strains that can produce a toxin that causes this type of response within our intestines.
What about cookie dough ice cream?
Well, cookie dough ice cream, while delicious, we We know that that type of cookie dough is processed in a way that is safe for consumption. However, if you were going to attempt to make any cookie dough ice cream at home or a cookie dough milkshake where you'd be putting in raw flour, things like that, that would not be safe for consumption.
How do they make the products in the cookie dough and the ice cream safe for consumption? What's the difference?
I cannot confess to know that information. I would probably check the website. My best guess is that they would be in some way pasteurizing flour or heating it to a temperature to kill any bacteria prior to putting that product in the food.
Hmm. Why does it feel like, at least, that these things often pop up in the winter? However, I've had very similar shows in the summer because of swimming pool contaminations.
Sure. It just depends on, the source of the outbreak. And right now, the most common sources are foodborne. And, given the holidays and people are, cooking those Christmas cookies and baking more, and they're just exposed to more of that potential contaminant.
Mm. And can you, not bake a cookie well enough? Is there a temperature or could it be that you consume partially baked cookie?
Absolutely. Mm. We always recommend, following package instructions on any, prepackaged food product that you would buy. And if you're cooking something yourself, just making sure that you're cooking things thoroughly and following the recipe instructions.
I wondered if you see any kind of connection between the microwave I don't even know what to call it, lifestyle that we live nowadays and people not cooking things long enough in a microwave.
That's a great question. I haven't personally seen any connection to that, but it would stand to reason that that is definitely a possibility.
Hmm. Tell us about some of the prevention tactics and how we can protect ourselves better.
Well, certainly following label directions to refrigerate products containing raw dough or eggs until they are cooked, making sure that when you are doing all of your holiday baking, that you are cleaning up thoroughly afterwards, after you're handling the flour, eggs, or raw dough, that you're wiping down surfaces with warm, soapy water, making sure that all of your utensils are cleaned appropriately, and, of course, washing your hands with warm and soapy water.
Wash your hands. Sarah Cawley, thank you so much for joining us today. I appreciate your time.
Happy holidays and be well.
Thank you. Sarah Cawley is a physician assistant in the Center for Functional Medicine at the Cleveland Clinic. Do not eat raw cookie dough. That's our parting message for you on that score. Stay with us for more Wellness Wednesday coming up on All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News. Welcome back to Wellness Wednesday. I'm your host, Ann Fisher. Soylent, an entirely vegan meal in a bottle drink, is hitting mainstream markets around the country. Proponents praise its convenience. Critics call it a fad. The December issue of the UC Berkeley School of Public Health Wellness Letter covers that and other health-related topics. Joining us now is the chair of the editorial board of the UC Berkeley School of Public Health Wellness Letter, Dr. John Swartzberg. Welcome back.
Thank you. Good morning.
So completely coincidentally, I think, unless it was like a subconscious urge, I watched Soylent Green last night, the 1973 movie, and it creeped me out all over again. And then when I started working on, preparing for today, I went, oh, my God, I don't even want to talk about this, Dr. Swartzberg.
Right. Yeah. I mean, that movie was back in 1973, and I sure remember it.
Oh, yeah.
And when we reviewed this topic, I really was surprised they picked that name.
Exactly.
Yeah.
Anyways, it's not about Soylent Green. It's not about that. But what is this stuff?
Well, it's really like other products that have been on the market for a long time, and that is just nutritional supplement products.
Mm-hmm.
It's got some added sugar, but it has a lot of good carbohydrates and protein and some healthy fats. So it's a dietary supplement in that sense.
Kind of like Ensure?
Yeah, exactly.
So why is this getting chatter when the stuff's already out there?
Well, it's not completely clear to us, and that's what we tried to make clear to our readers. It does have less sodium than some of the other products like Ensure that you mentioned and Boost, which is good because we probably get too much sodium in our diets. So that's one of the advantages to it. Originally, they promoted it as sort of as something that could substitute for food. They've backed off on that now and are promoting it more as an occasional meal or a meal in place of food, which is probably more wise. But frankly, I don't see anything that it has that makes it that much better or really any better than some of the other supplements on the market.
And you use the word supplement. These aren't, or what's the recommendation as far as thinking of them as replacements for a meal?
Right. Yeah, I think that's the key question. Is it a replacement or is it a supplement? And I think people could argue about that. Our position is that we don't really know all the ingredients in food and the particular combinations and concentrations of those ingredients, but we know that eating a healthy diet is the best thing we can do for ourselves in terms of nutrition. And to produce a product that has healthy things in it sounds fine, but it really doesn't include all of the kinds of things we don't know about yet. So I'd hate to see people think that they could drink one of these things and that would be as healthy as a good, healthy diet.
Diet is about more than the ingredients. It's the composition of the ingredients, too, isn't it?
Exactly. It's the composition of the ingredients, some of which we don't know about yet. And it's also about the different concentrations in those ingredients. So it may be that particular mixture with a certain amount of this and a certain amount of that that turns out to be what's so nutritious for us. So that apple a day, for example, it may be the different components, yes, but it could also be the different concentration of those components. And those are things that supplements like this really can't match.
So you recommend it as a supplement. When do you think people should think about using supplements?
Supplements like this, I think the settings tend to be in people who need extra calories and are having trouble consuming those. For example, people recovering from serious illnesses may need to use these kind of things to supplement their diet to get adequate nutrition. I think they can play a very important role there. Sometimes, particularly in the elderly, may have trouble chewing some things, and so this could add a supplement to their diet. Again, I think that would be an important role for these kind of products, but not to replace food.
You're listening to Wellness Wednesday on All Sides with Ann Fisher. My guest is Dr. John Swartzberg, chair of the editorial board of the UC Berkeley School of Public Health Wellness Letter. If you have a question or comment about any of these topics, give us a call, 614-292-8513, or email us at allsides@wosu.org. We're going to talk about the aspirin a day issue. If you take an aspirin a day and want to have some questions about that, give us a call. Why do people take low-dose aspirin once a day in the first place, Dr. Swartzberg?
Well, there's a good reason to take it, and that is if you have known cardiovascular disease, let's say you've had a heart attack in the past, there's a good reason to take aspirin a day because very good studies have shown that that will help prevent you from having a second heart attack. So that's what we call secondary prevention. So anybody who's had a heart attack should be on a baby aspirin a day. That's 81 milligrams. Now, of course, they should check with their doctor first before starting it. But that's where there's good science to support that approach. Where there's a question is in what's called primary prevention. And that is for those people who have never had or don't know about whether or not they have cardiovascular disease. They've never had a heart attack, for example. Should they be on aspirin? And that's where there's been a big debate in the literature. And doctors, frankly, go back and forth about this. And people actually in the field have gone back and forth about this. Finally, though, I think we have some pretty good data from which we can make some conclusions.
There's been several studies.
That's exactly right. Just this year, in July and then two papers in November, these are called the 3A studies. There was one study called ARRIVE, one called ASCEND, and one called ESPRIT. And they all tried to address this question about, for primary prevention, for people who have never had a heart attack, would it be a good idea to start aspirin, baby aspirin a day? And what these studies showed in aggregate was no. That there did not appear to be any advantage in those people who took a baby aspirin a day versus those who didn't. And for those who took a baby aspirin a day, there was a slightly higher chance of having a bleed, like a gastrointestinal bleed. So the bottom line appears from these three studies to be, in most circumstances, if you've not had a heart attack, you probably shouldn't be on aspirin.
The Bayer funded one of the studies, and I was just wondering, this is kind of a little off topic, but are those industry-funded studies as reliable?
I think one has to look at industry-funded studies with more of a jaundiced eye.
Okay.
That doesn't mean they're not reliable. It just means that somebody who's funding the study has a vested interest in the results.
Mm-hmm.
And so one has to be more careful in looking at how the study was done, whether there was a firewall between the support person funding the study and the people doing the research, et cetera. So I wouldn't rule out an industry-funded study, but I would look at it with a lot more carefully.
Mm-hmm. And the Bayer study, what did that look at?
Now, I'm not sure which one you're referring to, whether it was the ARRIVE, ASCEND, or ESPRIT.
Okay.
I think, although I'm not sure, it was the study that looked at older people with diabetes.
Okay.
And that particular group, they looked at well over 15,000 people, 40 and over, who had diabetes. And the reason that group was looked at is because we know that people with diabetes are at increased risk for a heart attack and a stroke. And so that would be a group that, if anybody would benefit in terms of primary prevention from aspirin, this would be the group.
Even though they hadn't had an episode.
Exactly. Primary prevention, mm-hmm. Right. And what this study showed was that the answer was that the people who took aspirin did not have a lower incidence of mm-hmm. Cardiovascular disease. They did have a slightly increased risk of bleeding, gastrointestinal bleeding, and that was of concern. But the bottom line was that aspirin didn't seem to be a protective effect, even in this higher risk group.
I just wanted to ask you a little bit about the gastrointestinal issue with aspirin. Why is there an issue with that?
Well, what aspirin does is it does a variety of things. It's actually a very interesting drug, and it's often been said that if somebody proposed to use aspirin today, it would have a tough time getting through the regulatory system because it has a lot of complications, but a lot of benefits too. One of the main things it does, and this probably plays a role in terms of cardiovascular disease, is that it makes our clotting less effective. So these cells that we produce called platelets that help our blood clot, it makes them less effective in terms of causing a clot. And that can be a benefit in terms of preventing a clot in our coronary arteries and therefore preventing a heart attack.
Mm-hmm.
The flip side is that it has a systemic effect. And so if there's any bleeding, for example, in our stomach or in the first part of our small bowel, the duodenum, and we're on aspirin, it can make the bleeding worse. People who take baby aspirin often will complain of the fact that they get these bruises on their hands,
right.
And they just barely hit themselves. And why is that? And it's because the blood just doesn't clot as well.
When somebody is being prescribed baby aspirin, the 81 milligrams, by their doctor, should they ask the doctor, what's the evidence for you prescribing this to me?
Well, that's an easy question. I think we all should ask our doctors, what's the evidence for your recommendation for anything?
Yeah.
But that said, I think the aspirin one is a real interesting question. And I think it's not, I don't want to come across as being, this is the dictum and you shouldn't be taking baby aspirin unless you've had a heart attack. I think it prompts a careful discussion with your physician. There may be circumstances in your particular case where the benefits might outweigh the risks, but these large studies looking at, in aggregate, close to 50 or 60,000 people didn't show a benefit.
Another study looked at people 65 and older because of heart disease, like people with diabetes. There is an elevated risk of heart disease in older people, right?
Right. The greatest risk for having a heart attack or stroke is age. The older we are, the greater risk we are at having one of those events, unfortunately. So that was the Esprit study that looked at people 65 and over. Again, looking at a pool of people, in this case it was 19,000 people in the United States and Australia, who had not had a heart attack, and to see whether aspirin would help prevent them from having one. And the bottom line to that study was, didn't seem to help.
There is a connection to colorectal cancer?
Yes, and that really complicates the picture. I'm glad you brought that up. There's pretty good evidence that people who have taken a baby aspirin a day or aspirin on a regular basis for 10 years have a lower risk for colorectal cancer. And that wasn't factored into these studies in terms of a primary endpoint. So people have queried, and this is why it's a very nuanced question, people have queried, well, maybe if there's a question about the benefits for preventing a heart attack and stroke, but if it clearly will prevent having colorectal cancer, then maybe that tilts the scales towards taking aspirin.
But it's a correlation, though. We don't know the causation, right?
We don't know for sure about causality. We do know it's a correlation. Mm-hmm. You're absolutely right. Nevertheless, there's pretty good science to suggest that this correlation there may be causality behind it. Again, this comes back to your point, and that is it's worth a discussion with your doctor. For example, somebody at very high risk for colorectal cancer, they have what's called multiple polyposis. They have lots of polyps, and the kind of polyps that predispose to cancer. These people, it may be a benefit to be on baby aspirin a day, but that's a conversation with your doctor and maybe with a specialist, a gastroenterologist.
Bone spurs. We're going to get out of the gut now. We're going to go to the heel. What are bone spurs? I've never had one. What are they?
Well, you may have them.
Okay.
I mean, most of us who live long enough, we wind up getting them. They're abnormal growths of bone, typically at the margins of joints. Where we tend to see them is where tendons and ligaments and muscles attach to bones. So in the spine, the shoulders, the hips, knees, and especially the heels are typical places to get these. And the vast majority of people who have these have absolutely no symptoms at all.
So why are they a problem then?
Because sometimes they do cause symptoms.
Is it pain?
I will mention that I remember reading in the papers a couple years ago that Trump got out of the military because he had bone spurs.
Oh, that's right, yeah.
Yeah. It's very unusual, by the way, to have bone spurs at the young age that he was, because typically they occur in older people.
Uh-huh.
But that said, sometimes those abnormal growths of bone can rub against other tissue and cause a symptomatology. They can cause chronic pain. They can cause decreased motion. So those are times when one needs to have some intervention.
And what would that be?
Well, the first thing is to get a proper diagnosis. Mm-hmm. And that's done by consultation with your physician and with an imaging study, typically with an X-ray or maybe a more specialized kind of X-ray, to look and see what the extent of the spur is and whether that would be the cause of your symptoms. If it's pretty clear that it is the cause of the symptoms, the conservative management is usually consultation with a physical therapist and finding ways to, for example, if it's your Achilles tendon, to cushion that area, find exercises and limbering up exercises that you could do that may help obviate the problem. So that's really the first thing to do.
Mm-hmm.
Simple measures like using acetaminophen, Tylenol, and sometimes non-steroidal anti-inflammatory drugs like Advil or Motrin, although I hate to see people using those on a regular basis.
Mm-hmm.
Those things can be helpful as well. In really bad situations where conservative management doesn't help, and this is unusual, but sometimes we have to turn to surgery to remove those surgically.
Mm-hmm.
And some people really require this to improve both the quality of their life and the ability to function well.
Why do they happen most commonly, or I guess that's what I'm familiar with them, is in the heel?
I think it's because of the wear and tear.
Okay.
I mean, every time we're on our feet, there's a lot of rubbing and a lot of weight on those tendons and the bone itself. And that tends to be a place, particularly for the Achilles tendon, right, that wraps around the heel, that every time we move our foot with a lot of weight on it, it's rubbing that bone. And so that over the years, that causes these bony outgrowths that we call spurs.
We only have a few minutes left, and I wanted to try to focus on the acute sinus infection and begin by asking you, what distinguishes an acute sinus infection from a garden variety sinus infection? Because those stink too.
They all stink.
Yeah.
Okay. An acute sinus infection is really probably what you're talking about in terms of the, quote, garden variety infection. And that's, you've had a cold and then you're getting better from the cold, but then you get localized pain over one of your sinuses. Typically, it's what's called the maxillary sinus, right above your upper teeth on one of the two sides. So you get pain there. You may have a funny smell from the bacteria that are growing, so you'll smell it in your nose. You may have some discharge from your nose that's pussy looking. Sometimes this is associated with fever. That's pretty classical acute sinusitis. It's not as common as people think, because I think acute sinusitis is diagnosed much too often when it's just really congestion of the sinuses with a cold.
Mm-hmm.
And most cases of that go away on their own without any intervention necessary at all. With characteristic acute sinusitis, where you've got infection in that sinus, in a localized sinus with pus coming out, those are the indications for antibiotics. I just want to make sure your readers understand that the vast majority of times we don't need antibiotics for congestion in our sinuses, and this is a big area where antibiotics are overprescribed.
Dr. John Swartzberg, thank you so much for your time today. I really appreciate it.
It's always a pleasure. Thank you.
Dr. John Swartzberg, chair of the editorial board of the UC Berkeley School of Public Health Wellness Letter. That's it for Wellness Wednesday today. Thank you so much for your attention. This is All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News.